Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Wednesday General Audience. Pope Benedict looks at the figures of Hugh and Richard St. Victor in his continuing catechesis on leading theologians of the Middle Ages. Women targeted. As we mark the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, we hear testimony from Thailand and Kenya that illustrates how violence against women and girls is a problem of pandemic proportions, with at least one out of every three women around the world becoming a victim. And dying for life. More than 500,000 women, the overwhelming majority of them in developing nations, die each year due to complications relating to pregnancy and giving birth. And we find out from a leading campaigner on this issue why almost nobody is talking about this hemorrhage of human life. Here in the Vatican, at his Wednesday General Audience, Pope Benedict looked at the figures of Hugh and Richard St. Victor, two leading theologians from the 12th century. Lydia Kane tells us more.
Pope Benedict, during his weekly General Audience on Wednesday, spoke about not one but two theologians as he continued his catechesis on the Christian culture of the Middle Ages. Both men, Saints Hugh and Richard, lived in the 12th century and were associated with the monastery of St. Victor in Paris.
Hugh of St. Victor stressed the importance of the literal or historical sense of sacred scripture as a basis of theology's effort to unite faith and reason in understanding God's saving plan. His treatise on the sacrament of the Christian faith offered an influential definition of a sacrament, stressing not only its institution by Christ and its communication of grace, but also its value as an outward sign. Richard of St. Victor, disciple of Hugh, stressed the allegorical sense of the scriptures in order to present a spiritual pedagogy aimed at human maturity and contemplative wisdom.
The Pope then, as he spoke about these early saints, emphasized how the world would be a very different place if people lived by the example of love found in the Trinity. He also added that only love makes us happy because we live to love and be loved.
Richard's work on the Trinity sought to understand the mystery of the Triune God by analyzing the mystery of love, which entails a giving and receiving between two persons, and finds its perfection in being bestowed upon a third person. The great Victorians, Hugh and Richard, remind us that theology is grounded in the contemplation born of faith and the pursuit of understanding, and brings with it immense joy of experiencing the eternal love of the Blessed Trinity.
At the end of his audience, the Pope had words of welcome for the English speakers present, including the pilgrimage of bishops and faithful from Japan, celebrating the first anniversary of the beatification of Blessed Peter Kibe and companions. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Show me how to lay my life for them.
It's a problem that affects at least one out of every three women around the world. But all too often, its victims suffer in silence, sometimes too ashamed to seek help. We're talking about the issue of violence against women. It's a violence that takes many forms and occurs in many places, be it rape, domestic violence in the home, trafficking, and many other types of physical or emotional abuse. As we mark Wednesday's International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, let's shine the spotlight on this often neglected problem that, according to the UN, is of pandemic proportions and arguably one of the most pervasive human rights violations that we know today. Whilst violence against women is a global phenomenon and cuts across all ethnic, social and economic boundaries, there are certain circumstances where the incidence of violence, especially rape, tends to skyrocket. and that's in countries affected by war and conflict and the resulting breakdown of law and order. Rape as a weapon of war. That's a description we often hear used in connection with the ongoing conflict in the eastern DR Congo, where violence against women and girls, sometimes as young as toddlers, is almost endemic. War and conflict also causes massive displacement of the local population, and women who are forced to flee their homes, and sometimes their country as well, are particularly vulnerable to sexual abuse. Angelica Mendes is a communications officer for Jesuit Refugee Services, or JRS, in the Eastern Africa region, where many refugees who fled from the conflict in the DR Congo have sought sanctuary. But, as this one story about a Congolese refugee illustrates, violence against women doesn't just occur in the war-torn Congo, but can strike at any time.
I'm thinking of a story of a refugee woman in Kampala, Bakola. Her husband was murdered and she fled first to Burundi and then to Uganda with four children. And JRS had to start a small tailoring business in Kampala so that she could pay for the children's education, for food, accommodation, healthcare. But 2 years ago, she was attacked and she was raped by six men in front of her children. And after they beat her almost to death and they looted the house and all they could find. So after this attack, she even gave birth to a baby boy. And of course, I mean, all this left her deeply wounded. So now JRS supports her with food and rent. And we also refer her to another agency where she receives specific medication and attends counseling sessions. And that's just one story that illustrates the plight of many women, especially refugee women in Kampala, who come mostly from Congo and who have been raped there. And then sometimes they have the same experience in the country where they actually sought refuge.
Teach us how to love in the pain, woman of God.
Anna Sampson is an advocacy officer for JRS in Thailand, and she spoke to me about the level of violence levelled against women there, both in the female population at large and also among the refugees who have fled to Thailand from conflicts in Burma, Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, I don't think that Thai society is particularly different from any sorts of societies, both in Southeast Asia and more generally in the world. I think that women are at risk of violence most commonly from partners and from people that they know, as well as the other forms of violence that they experience at the hands of strangers. Because unfortunately, despite this being the 21st century, women are still at a high risk of harassment within the home, of violence that's perpetrated not only of the physical kind, but also of the economic and psychological kind. And they're also at risk from traveling when they're in the workplace in terms of sexual harassment by employers and their colleagues. I think that that this sort of experience of women that we see as being quite common here in Thailand is the sort of experience that women face everywhere around the world.
And as far as you know, do many women who are the victims of violence report it to the police or the authorities, or are there many, you think, who suffer in silence?
Again, I think that there is a dramatic underreporting of violence against women by women who experience such harassment, discrimination and violence. And again, I don't think that Thai society is particularly different from other societies, that what we do see, and in fact, statistics that are produced that indicate that there has been a rise of violence against women actually tend to reflect more the fact that women are increasingly feeling more comfortable with reporting these incidents. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's been an overall increase or even that the statistics that we're seeing actually accurately reflect the extent of violence that's perpetrated against women. But I think that this is definitely indicative of the fact that so many women do still feel that the violence that's perpetrated against them might be somehow their fault, that the violence will not be taken seriously, that there will be no redress for the wrong that's been perpetrated against them. And I think working for JRS and the women that we see who are most particularly asylum seekers and refugees, that we see very high incidences of underreporting by women who are the victims of violence, who are the victims of violence both in their home countries, which is often one of the leading factors for causing them to flee, but also during transit and then when they arrive in Thailand as their final destination country in the place that they're actually seeking protection.
So you get refugees coming, as you say, from not just Burma, but from Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Somalia and Iraq, often countries, as you say, where there is a lot of violence or even an armed conflict. So they're fleeing from situations of violence there. How many of them, for instance, have been raped?
Well, as we know, rape is still considered, well, it is a tool and a weapon of war, and women are the victims of the use of that weapon predominantly. So we do see a number of refugees and asylum seekers here in Thailand who will have suffered some form of sexual trauma or sexual violence that's been perpetrated against them. And if they've been living through a conflict situation or a conflict-like situation, the risk and the incidence of such sexual violence is much higher. And again, this is just simply because within conflict situations, women are seen as partly repositories of culture and therefore legitimate targets within a conflict. But they're also seen as a way in which the enemy can be defeated. And so to treat women in this way is considered a legitimate part of engaging within a conflict or as part of the war. And of course, this is a situation that is outlawed under international law, and there are very strong conventions and legal instruments that indicate that treatment of women in this way is against international principles. So, of course, part of what JRS attempts to do in working with women who are refugees and asylum seekers is to highlight these very high incidents of sexual violence against women in conflict situations and attempt to address those root causes.
You say a high incidence, but do you have any figures? Do you have any indication at all what percentage we're talking about?
Well, we would say that almost every woman that approaches us for assistance and who we see as a refugee and asylum seeker would have experienced some form of violence or trauma, and usually sexual violence.
And is this usually at the hands of armed groups, or could it be sometimes even members of the woman's family or community?
Well, I guess this is partly about the complex nature of the refugee experience and the refugee experiences for women refugees. Violence that is experienced by women who are fleeing or seeking protection can occur at every stage along their journey. So it can occur in their home country, where it might be perpetrated at the hands of rebel groups or armed groups or the military or the police. It could happen at the hands of their own family or community members for various reasons, violation of presumed cultural norms and the like. It can happen at the point of transit, so when women are attempting to leave the situation of persecution or violence, when they're at risk at the hands of traffickers, or when they're trying to protect their children, when they're crossing borders, which is, of course, a very risky thing to do when women are at risk of violence at that stage during flight. But then they are also at risk and they experience violence in their host country. So just because they've managed to leave the situation that caused their flight to begin with and they've escaped that violence, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're free from violence in their host country. So they can arrive in a country of destination and still be at risk if they end up in a refugee camp. There can be women who experience violence within the camp from other refugees, camp leaders and camp management, from NGO workers, people who work for the United Nations, and they face violence within their employment situations because, of course, many times, and particularly here in Thailand, they're unlawful because they're undocumented. And therefore, they work in a situation where their employers exercise a lot of power over them. So, unfortunately, the nature of the refugee women's experience is one that is peppered by violence, and it's almost a part of their everyday existence. And women are very resilient, and they've learned to cope with it, and they've developed strategies for managing these risks and for minimizing it, and most importantly, for protecting their children from these risks. But it is definitely something that they face almost daily.
So how badly traumatized are some of these women who've undergone all these terrible things, and how does JRS reach out and help them?
Look, I think that women are severely traumatized by these events, and frankly, how could you not be? I think that they're quite natural and understandable responses to the experiences that they have suffered. But at the same time, I think definitely anybody who works with refugees and asylum seekers witnesses an incredible resilience on the part of these women and of all refugees and asylum seekers, I think. So despite these significant levels of trauma, which can, of course, manifest in psychological and physical and somatic conditions, but at the same time, I think these women have developed very good coping strategies. And JRS in Thailand, but also in other countries where we work, prides itself in working very closely with communities and in building strong communities, strong refugee communities that are better equipped and better resourced to support the members of that community. Because refugees are really in the best position, if they are well-resourced and supported, to help themselves and to be seen as the agents and the catalyst for change. Teach us to
believe. Trying to eradicate the epidemic of violence against women means going to the roots of the problem. And as Angelica explains, this is a difficult and long-term process that often involves trying to change deeply ingrained cultural attitudes and traditions.
And we can say that there are basically three major root causes. One are poor legal frameworks. Another one is the impunity and the acceptance with which society and governments treat violence against women. And the third one is the low status of women in society. So to find the right method of prevention, first of all, we have to make sure that appropriate laws are adopted and enforced. And in fact, during the last decade, several laws on an international, on a regional, but also on a national level have been adopted. But the gaps between legislation and enforcement are still vast, and they haven't translated into increased protection for women and girls. So now the real challenge is to enforce these laws and to translate existing policies into concrete programs that actually benefit women and girls. On the second root cause, we need to change people's behavior and an attitude towards violence, which of course requires long-term commitment. And the responsibility here really extends to everyone. It is extremely important to support and sustain an environment in which violence against women and girls is not tolerated. And then, of course, we need to support and empower the women themselves, which plays a key role to surmount the challenges.
That was Angelica Mendes, and you earlier heard the voice of Anna Sampson, who both work for Jesuit Refugee Services. As the word suggests, women who give birth are engaged in a taxing act of bringing forth a new human life. But sometimes that life-giving act can mean death for the mother. In the West nowadays, the number of women who die in childbirth is almost negligible. But in developing nations, especially in Africa, more than 500,000 women die each year due to complications arising from pregnancy and during delivery. Dr. Robert Wally, founder and director of the Catholic healthcare organisation MartyrCare, says this huge loss of life is like a jumbo jet of mothers crashing every 4 hours. But unlike a major plane crash, these dramatic statistics rarely get much mention in the industrialised world. He spoke to me about how he is trying to raise awareness of this problem and seek to overcome a chronic lack of political will to boost funding for maternal care in developing nations.
We don't actually know the number of maternal deaths. Extremely difficult to calculate and so on. But my own experience, for example, in Nigeria, was that there were 1,700 per 100,000 live births, the number of deaths, 1,700, whereas in Canada it would be about 1 per 100,000. So the enormity is there. All of us who are in the field see the numbers of maternal deaths, but we quote those as being the figure. Okay, what's happening to that figure is it's not changing.
It's not going down.
No. It, in fact, in some places it's going up. One or two countries have shown a change, and what it means is that there isn't the same amount of urgency. There is this what we call a conspiracy of silence. There's no political interest in a maternal death. As, for example, AIDS, every politician in the world has to be involved in AIDS because it's a serious problem. It's a pandemic. It's killing people. So everybody has to be involved. But when, from the Western point of view, there's no interest in maternal deaths because nobody dies in our hospitals. Nobody dies in Canada, in London, in Rome, because we've got all the equipment. We've got all the trained staff. Whereas in Africa, there is a neglect. It's neglect all the way down the line. So the woman is left to deliver by herself in a village without anybody.
So, as you said, I mean, childbirth should be this act of giving birth to life, but so often that person who brings forth this new life is actually dying in the process.
Absolutely. And there's nothing more tragic, you know, than dying. And I remember talking to a sister once, and she said, you know, it doesn't matter what a woman might have done any time during her life before, whatever she might have done, if she dies giving birth to a new life, she goes straight to God. Because that is something so profound. And for us as Catholics, the whole question of motherhood is absolutely of a profound importance, because we wouldn't be here without it.
And I gather, apart from these deaths, that for every woman who dies, there's approximately 20 more who suffer injuries, infections and disabilities. Tell us something about these injuries.
One of the most terrible, really, is a kind of a living death. It occurs because of injury to the bladder and the rectum. And what happens then is the mother becomes incontinent of urine and faeces. And everybody knows how we kind of think of incontinence, even in our own babies.
So they're ostracised by their communities?
Absolutely, because of obvious reasons. They're offensive to everybody. And in some places, they're actually seen as having been, this is an act of God on them, because they were unfaithful. So it's a huge problem. It's not properly identified, again, because they're hidden away. It's so shameful. But it was a huge problem in the Western world over 150 years ago. New York, they set up a fistula hospital, would you believe? But it took 100 years almost before the next one was set up by two Australians in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and that runs to this day. It's a superb place. It's the example for everybody. But when you try to say, look, something ought to be done about this problem, when you go to the aid agencies, government agencies, your kind of eyes glaze over. They've never heard of it, so why worry about it?
And how easy is it to treat this problem?
It can be very easy once you know what you're doing. So a simple fistula, there's a rules of how to do the surgery, but basically you could train most doctors to do it. You don't have to be specialists. But then, as we say, with some surgery and obstetrics, it takes you a year to learn how to do a cesarean section, 2 years to know when to do one, and then 3 years when to not to do one. So the same applies here. You've got to know what you're doing. You've got to be able to identify it. And there's so few people, experts in this area, that are able to train the next generation. It's a huge problem. WHO says 2 million cases, probably, at least that.
Where are there places in the developing world? You talked about this place in Addis Ababa, but, I mean, presumably they're few and far between. Are there some places where women can get this help?
There are other centres in Africa that are doing this work. But again, they're not large. There's not enough money put into these sort of things. And there's not enough trained personnel. You have to have a separate fistula hospital. Why? Well, because people don't like to have hospital. People don't like to have these patients in the hospital because they're offensive. And often, you know, we're not just talking about a physical injury. We're talking about the problems this has created above the eyebrows.
For their psyche.
Yeah. They've gone through terrible discrimination. They've been treated so badly that their whole image of themselves is so awful. And so they need a lot of love and rehabilitation, basically.
Now, apart from this fistula problem, what other risks do women in developing countries run, you know, if their labour doesn't go smoothly?
Well, they go into obstructed labour. See, the whole problem is we have the same complications here in Rome, but we have the facilities to do something about it. So if a mother goes into obstructed labour, we identify it. We're trained to do that. And so caesarean section is quickly done. Over there, if you're obstructed labour, when you're in a village on your own, you just die. Agonising. May go on for days and days, but you die. The uterus may rupture in the process and you die. The commonest cause of dying is hemorrhage after the baby's born, postpartum hemorrhage.
Which, of course, was the problem in the Western world.
Absolutely. But can you imagine, I ask even the listeners to imagine what it's like to exsanguinate while you're conscious. It must be extraordinarily terrifying. And these are the things that I'm trying to say. Look, we hear about all of these conferences going on to decide how to do something about maternal mortality. You're not going to solve the problem unless you provide every mother with somebody who cares for, who's a specialist trained or properly trained, the facilities and the hospitals, all of which we have in Rome and take for granted. But over there, there's nothing. So when you go to the funding agencies, or the governments, I think they're the problem. The government agencies don't want to put money into essential obstetrics. They talk about it, but then they say, OK, like they did at the United Nations Fund for Population Activities just recently in Addis, they came out and said, well, the best solution to solving maternal mortality is family planning. But then what do you do about those who are pregnant? You can't be a maternal death if you're not pregnant. So, but it sounds good. It sounds wonderful, you know. But at the end of the day, all of those people who are at that conference, all of us sitting here want the best for our wives and sisters and, you know, so on. But Africa wants that too. developing countries want that too. And I think it's just an international disgrace. If everybody sits down at the UN and they say the same thing over and over, well, I'm very sorry, the fifth millennium development goal, we're not meeting that goal. And the British Medical Journal pointed out that it'll take 275 years at the present rate of progress to get that goal. Well, it shows that everybody is like the Levite, passing on the other side of the road and looking the other way. It's outrageous.
And coming back to this question of obstructed labour, I read that women whose growth has been stunted or maybe have not had enough to eat or who are malnourished are also more liable to get these complications, aren't they?
Sure, malnutrition will affect the growth of, in the long term, of the future mother. So she is not a good, she doesn't reproduce well, deliver well. But then also malnutrition plays a part when she's pregnant. You know, if she's malnourished, her baby's malnourished. And that leads to all sorts of long-term complications for the baby.
Yes, coming to the baby, in fact, of course, if the mother dies, as you say, or is left permanently injured as a result of childbirth, what happens to this child? Who takes care of it?
Absolutely.
Who nurses it?
Who? Nobody. Often there's nobody. If she's died, there's nobody to look after the baby. And it will die. If the mother dies, the baby dies. And then the under-fives will die in that family. And it will die. If the mother dies, the baby dies. And then the under-fives will die in that family.
So it's a whole chain, isn't it?
It is a chain. It's like a domino effect. And we in the church, I think, are pitched in the right place. We understand motherhood. We accept motherhood. It's of value to us. We talk about, it's coming up to Christmas, the Immaculate Conception beforehand. We talk about, you remember that pious devotion to the seven sorrows of Our Lady? Well, I think here's an eighth. She kind of weeps when she sees the neglect, what is happening in the world. And it wouldn't take much. We can spend 1.8, was it, trillion on armaments for all the wars that are going on, then something like 8 trillion bailing out banks, it would cost a few hundred billion to do something about this.
A fraction.
I don't even know what a trillion is, but all I know is what the problem is. And it means that the world, except us in the church, because we have a moral obligation to do something about it. We can't just walk away. The church responded, you know, in a profound way, as the whole world did back in the early 80s when the pandemic for AIDS occurred. I'm just saying, why couldn't we do that now for motherhood? Something like a Marshall Plan, you know, that was there at the end of the Second World War. It was put there to keep out communism and so on. Here we want to produce that because there's a need to look after mothers and to keep out a sort of a culture of death, which is the antithesis of what people like. Women over there love babies. They see that as the future. And they're saying, the only thing we've got here is babies, and you want to take that away from us as well. And it's egregious to say, look, you won't die if we kill your baby.
I know you've just come back from Kenya, where you've been looking at a project that you're funding. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the situation there for mothers who give birth?
I've worked in Nigeria and Ghana and now in Kenya, and this area is the toughest I've worked in. So we've put this, a rural obstetrical program, where we're training traditional birth attendants to refer mothers to the parish clinics. The parish clinics will be able to do normal deliveries because they're trained midwives. So we're overcoming that skill problem, or lack of skill problem.
So you said that the situation is very difficult there because of drought and presumably grinding poverty. So, I mean, what happens now mostly to mothers then who have a problem with their pregnancy or their delivery?
They die. I mean, one of our nurses out there, she said, I had 5 maternal deaths in the village last month. And mothers, unfortunately, women don't have that value.
They don't have the voice.
They don't have the voice.
I was speaking to Dr. Robert Wally, founder and director of the Catholic healthcare organisation, MartyrCare. Woman of God. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.